From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
We continue our look back at 2016 with part two of our discussion with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. So, Tony, happy new year, and hope 2017 is better than 2016.
Yeah, happy new year to you as well, Don, and all anybody listening.
So, yeah, we got to pick up where we left off.
I'm quite optimistic about 2017, and perhaps as we talk, kind of the reasons why.
Yeah, fill us in, definitely. Now, where were we, though? We were going to pick up at, you said, Venezuela and Colombia. So let's go there, yeah. And you can tell us about this on the way.
Right, well, in Colombia, it looks as though the peace process is unstoppable now, because there have been various votes in the legislature, and there have been judgments in the Supreme Court, all approving in very positive way. It's not in a contested way. The provisions of the peace agreement,
right.
And the big question is, and the only political grouping that is against the peace agreement is the a political grouping that represents the narco terrorist paramilitaries,
right.
Led by Álvaro Uribe.
Right.
Now, Álvaro Uribe in Colombia is able to present himself as a kind of almost respectable figure because of the structure of Colombia's society and politics.
Mm-hmm.
But as the peace process advances, one of the reasons he resists it is because it's going to make him and the political constituency that he represents more and more irrelevant in terms of national politics.
Right. I mean, if you have rule of law, then there's no role for narco-terrorists anymore. And without narco-terrorists, Uribe doesn't have a base. It goes down. But I just wanted to make sure that we amplify the statement peace agreement to the Made in Havana peace agreement.
Yeah. And very, very much in debt to Comandante Hugo Chavez and to Fidel.
Yep, absolutely.
And to all the Cuban
and
leadership.
Raul, yep, the whole leadership.
And to the Venezuelan government that assumed power following the tragic death of Comandante Hugo Chavez. But the important thing to understand about Colombia is that there are all kinds of internal power struggles going on within the Colombian elite. And there's some misgivings among even the people that support Santos about to what extent they're creating too big a space for radical revolutionary politics to make their case within the context of Colombia's existing political system. And so there's all kinds of tensions going on. The big thing to be on the lookout for through 2017 will be the level of violence that Álvaro Uribe is able or willing to implement in order to sabotage the agreement.
You know, and it's going to be a good testing ground for Trump, by the way, because really Uribe is not going to be able to do this without either the assent of the United States or perhaps even if the other forces settle things down and bring some unity against the narco-terrorists. With the active involvement of the United States. If Trump meant this thing about no regime change and all of that, then Uribe will be on his own. That's a different dynamic, I think.
Yeah, and there's a lot of uncertainty about how things are going to play out, but that is one of the key indicators, if you like, to be alert to. Also one of the encouraging things through 2016, and partly in relation to Colombia as well, has been the progress that Nicolas Maduro and his colleagues have been able to make in Venezuela and overcoming one very serious difficulty after another right through 2016, which gives a lot of optimism for the outlook into 2017 and beyond, because And I think Venezuela's elections are in 2019. Nicolas Maduro has 2 years in order to continue to consolidate the gains that he and his colleagues have made through 2016. And they've overcome the dramatic crash in the oil price. They've overcome the disastrous election results in the legislature at the end of 2015, which handed the National Assembly to the right-wing opposition, who have been truly pathetic all through. Their performance all through 2016 has been absolutely dreadful.
It's like watching one of those clown cars in vaudeville or something, literally. I mean, they used it for the Republicans here, but it actually is like that visual, what happens in the National Assembly down there.
Well, yeah. And you see, on almost all fronts, I mean, there are still lots of structural difficulties that Venezuela has got to overcome. But they've made huge achievements in housing. They've managed to stabilize the oil price through Venezuela's really superb diplomacy all through 2016. They've overcome the really extreme effects of the drought that drastically affected electrical generation, and a whole series of challenges that Nicolas Maduro has and his colleagues have met and overcome, and they still have very serious difficulties to overcome. In particular, they've got to try and resolve the issue of diversifying Venezuela's economy away from dependence on oil. But if you look at their budget for 2017, 71% of that budget is dedicated to social spending.
Yeah.
You know, that's unique in the world.
That's right.
And the fact that they've been able to do that within the context of all the difficulties that they've had ever since the death of Comandante Hugo Chavez is a really tremendous vindication of Nicolas Maduro himself as an individual and of his ministerial team. The reason that all that is important in terms of Colombia is that the Colombian paramilitaries have depended very heavily on contraband and smuggling from Venezuela, that the Venezuelan authorities have done a great deal to control. It's still a very serious problem. But it's in the interest of Juan Manuel Santos to control that, because that way he can cut off funding for the paramilitaries that are the political base for Álvaro Uribe.
That's right.
And that'll make it harder for them to sabotage the implementation of the peace agreement. So that's developments in Venezuela are very important also for the peace agreement in Colombia.
Yeah, and you know, in Colombia with Dos Santos, he's got, essentially, he has tied his political fate to accomplishing this. So, I mean, objective conditions have created where he has to do that, but it's in his political interest to make this peace agreement work.
Right. So that all through 2017, and that'll be a very interesting set of developments to be following, because the fates of Venezuela and Colombia are very obviously very much intertwined. And then turning to Cuba, and Cuba has accumulated a new enormous prestige as a result of throughout Latin America, as a result of their facilitation of the peace agreement in Colombia, which was the last major conflict in the region. And it's, and when Fidel died, he must have died with having the great satisfaction of having achieved that in his lifetime.
Oh yeah, you know,
the conflict in Colombia has been, what is it, 50 years?
Almost 60, and resolve that.
Years.
You know, there's another tie-in too, by the way, with Cuba. Go back to Venezuela for a second before we continue, because you know, the difficult period that Venezuela has apparently just passed through, that they're, you know, coming out of now, you have the historical, almost immediate historical antecedent or precedent of the special period in Cuba. They got by with a hell of a lot less. You know, they had no oil revenues, they had no oil, and no lots of other things, and they managed to get through it. And, you know, Fidel, I'm sure, was able to counsel Maduro on how to navigate some of these difficulties. And I think that that is probably partly responsible for the success that the Maduro's had in managing, you know, all the difficulties he had to deal with, plus with a hostile, if incompetent, National Assembly.
Yeah, and I think that's obviously true, that Nicolas Maduro is very, and his colleagues are very much the beneficiary of the experiences of Fidel and Raul and their revolutionary colleagues, and also leaders like Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua, who's a past master at checkmating the political opposition here. Oh, yeah. And also, of course, Nicolas Maduro will have had the benefit of the experience, in particular the economic expertise of Rafael Correa and his team, and also the political experience of Evo Morales in Bolivia. And talking about Bolivia and Ecuador, in my opinion, one of the most important developments through 2017 will be the outcome, or the developing outcome, of the struggle between Argentina and Brazil and Paraguay and Venezuela in Mercosur, which is that trade bloc that originally was founded by Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay and Paraguay, and was pretty moribund until Hugo Chavez implemented the integration of Venezuela into Mercosur, and Venezuela's influence was actually giving a new dynamic to Mercosur.
Yeah, I mean, I look at the creation of Mercosur as when Venezuela joined it, because that's what the current Mercosur, or the immediately past Mercosur, was when Venezuela came in and used it as an instrumentality for the development of the region.
Yeah, regional integration. And yep. That is going to be a key theme through 2017. And you can see, for example, just over the last few days, and Evo Morales has signed an agreement with the extreme right-wing government of Paraguay under President Horacio Cartes for the intercontinental railway that I think China is projected to build, going from Peru through Bolivia, Paraguay and Uruguay. And so that seems to me quite symbolic of the essential dilemma for the regional right wing, because they want to develop trade with China, but they're trying to impose a free trade framework and a kind of neoliberal Washington consensus free trade framework. I hate using that word, free trade.
That's, you put it in quotes or with a registered trademark after it, whatever. Yeah.
So we talked about this over the last couple of years on different occasions. There's a kind of contradiction between the right wing government's need to access all the benefits of trade with China and Russia and India, and I think Peru is now negotiating a free trade agreement with India. And yet Peru is under a right-wing government at the moment as well, as it has been for years. But that opening out towards China and Asia in general is both an opportunity and a challenge and a threat, if you like, to the right-wing agenda in the region. Because for it to work, they've got to integrate. They've got to integrate infrastructure.
That's right.
And as they integrate infrastructure, and that means that they then have to reach accommodations with the progressive governments of Ecuador, and which is likely to, Ecuador has elections in February next year, which are likely to be won by the party of Rafael Correa. Rafael Correa isn't running for re-election, but his candidate looks as though he's set fair to win those elections. We'll see.
Yeah, he's term limited. He can't run, right?
Right. So the Ecuador, Bolivia, to some extent Chile, it was very disappointing, the response of Michelle Bachelet to the attempts by Argentina and Brazil and Paraguay to squeeze Venezuela out of Mercosur. That was there. There was that unprecedented incident in which the foreign minister, Delcy Rodriguez of Venezuela, was actually struck by Argentinian police. She was hit by an Argentinian security guard when she attempted to join a meeting of the Mercosur Council, which she was entitled to be a member of, participating in. And eventually she did actually get entry to the meeting, which immediately broke up for lunch. You know, that was absolutely unprecedented. It shows to the extent to which Mauricio Macri and his colleagues are, they're essentially kind of a rerun of the fascist regimes of the 1970s and early 1980s in Argentina.
Yeah, but we also have a rerun of that behavior by the United States last week with the Russian diplomats. It seems that there was a policy decision made, I'm guessing in Washington, that this is the new diplomatic norm, and so that was allowed. I'm certain that that was allowed with, you know, perhaps even scripted by, you know, in Washington, because this stuff is unprecedented treatment of diplomats. You don't do that.
Right. Yeah, and I believe that one of the legacies of Obama is a collapse in the prestige, insofar as it existed previously, or respect. Perhaps prestige is the wrong word. Perhaps respect is the wrong word. There's a collapse in respect around the world for U.S. diplomacy.
Yeah, and a collapse in respect by the United States of international law, just out in the open. I mean, they act contemptuously against even diplomatic norms.
Yeah, and that's one of the most surprising events over the last couple of months was the U.S. abstention in the vote on the Palestinian occupied territory.
No, and it's treated like some emancipatory, you know, this is the Emancipation Proclamation for the people of Palestine, that the U.S. abstained.
Yeah, it is, and the double standards are absolutely astonishing. Yep. And dismaying.
There's something I want to get to, because what you were talking about before, if I could interrupt for a minute on this train, You're seeing, starting in Colombia, but this phenomenon you're describing, where even these right-wing governments have to move towards integration, you're seeing right-wing governments essentially being forced to govern from the left, at least in fundamental ways. The economic is fundamental, and it's fundamental in terms of the political in Colombia, what Dos Santos is doing. Yeah. He has to tie his fate to a peace agreement that, by the way, was brokered in Havana, because his political survival depends on it.
Right, but that cuts both ways as well, because because of the continuing dominance of international finance in particular, by Western banking institutions, Western financial institutions, Western global financial monsters like Goldman Sachs and so forth, and they're continually bailing themselves out, and they co-opted governments to such an extent that even though domestic economic policy is affected negatively by the dominance of the financial sector, they're still able to maintain the political dominance of their interests so as to defend themselves. And that is true. That is a phenomenon also at an international level.
Right.
And so, for example, that was one of the things that made the last couple of years of Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner's government in Argentina so difficult. It was one of the things that facilitated the coup against Dilma Rousseff in Brazil. And so that because Western financial interests still have an enormous influence over global markets, of money markets, commodity markets, and so forth, insurance markets, for example. And that makes it very, very difficult for progressive governments, and what you can see that here in Nicaragua, it makes it very difficult for Nicaraguan, for progressive governments to develop a truly independent economic policy.
Right.
And because they have to make concessions across the board in all right. kinds of ways
right.
to the dominant economic and financial structures. And that is what's going to make 2017 so interesting in terms of
yeah.
how the conflicting agendas between right. the right-wing governments currently in power in Brazil and Argentina negotiate some kind of accommodation with the progressive governments that have been much more successful, and certainly in domestic terms and even in international trade terms, than their right-wing counterparts. And that's, I think, perhaps Peru and Chile are the only exceptions to that. You and I have discussed for years now the development of this multipolar world that is now very much a reality.
For sure.
And the defeat of the Western attempts at regime change in Syria seems to me to be a strategic defeat that's going to serve as a watershed. We'll look back on that as a watershed.
Agreed, yeah.
And so what the question now is, certainly in Latin America, what kind of accommodation is going to be reached through 2017, 2018, between the conflicting right-wing agenda and the left-wing agenda?
Right, and the mechanical process that's used.
You can see that in Mexico. China had virtually no influence in Mexico 5, 6, 7 years ago.
Right.
And now it's becoming an increasingly important trade partner for Mexico, which, of course, is a member of NAFTA.
I mean, China, look, if China wants to be a player in any of these places, you describe a condition where, you know, Western capital has a monopoly, Western finance capital has a monopoly essentially on capital markets. So these people are forced to deal on their terms with Wall Street and London. China has the wherewithal to simply buy that paper, for example, and suddenly redefine the relationship between, you know, that debt and the behavior of these countries.
Yeah, certainly in a very low-key way, China has been absolutely crucial to the efforts by Nicolas Maduro to overcome the very serious structural and short-term problem, political problems that he's been so successful in combating. And without the support of China, and to a lesser extent perhaps Russia, it would have been very difficult for Nicolas Maduro to sustain the kind of policies that he's been with great success able to implement through 2016, despite all the difficulties.
Yep.
No, and so China's influence is increasingly influential across Latin America, and that's one of the things that makes me think that Donald Trump's anti-China rhetoric is more than anything rhetoric. Because it's very difficult to see how the United States is, under any circumstances, going to be able to recoup the economic power and influence that it's had in Latin America, short of the kinds of coups and overt political intervention that we've been seeing over the last few years.
Well, you know, I mean, okay, there is an objective condition that has to be looked at. You have these two models that are offered to people in the region and around the world pretty much. One is a model, we're going to loot your country. The other is a model, we want to make money with you, so we're going to help you develop your country so you can buy stuff from us. And you can build a lot of it there so you can hire your people so they have money to buy the stuff from us, and vice versa. And, you know, that which is the model between, you know, Western finance capital and what China and other countries, but China and that bloc have been offering to Latin America, to Africa, to whoever wants to do business. And you develop a constituency among the people, first of all, by holding out an alternative to the misery that they're suffering at the moment that they can usually name. And so the soil is pretty fertile for that kind, politically, I think, for that kind of engagement with China in the region. And the wherewithal, like I said, all they have to do, for example, was buy the debt. They got the cash laying around. They could cash in some U.S. securities for it, for example, if they wanted to, and be deeply engaged in almost a closed system. And I'm wondering if we're going to see any movement towards that this year.
And who knows, Don? I suspect that China will continue to very carefully and in an incremental way increase its influence and power in Latin America. Well, one of the crucial things, apart from the economics, and the underlying economics that depend very much on political developments, and the political development, is a given economic trend going to happen quicker or slower?
Right.
And it's it seems to me that it's the political aspect that determines that.
Right.
And one of the things that's going to be really important is whether the majority, especially young people, in countries like Brazil and Argentina, are going to be able to express their aspirations and in a way that it's going to be either, it's not necessarily inevitable that the expression of their aspirations will follow a left-wing political trend.
Right, that's
because economically it should, but there are so many other factors involved.
I think if you look at Nicaragua, if I can interrupt you there, because I think I get your point. If you look at Nicaragua, you have essentially enlisted the domestic bourgeoisie in the project of developing the country, and that group really that had previously tied its fate to Western capital or whoever was sweeping in from Washington and from Europe. And that has been exhausted. They can't be the comprador class anymore because there's nothing left to take almost. And in any event, the conditions that support that domestically just aren't there anymore. The people have had enough. So they are in Nicaragua, they are involved in developing the country and they're making money that way. And that example is seen by others, and that dynamic is in place in many of these other countries. So I think that's the point you're trying to make.
Yeah, and also, given that that's the case, the logical response of the United States must be to sow division, to create disunity, to provoke confrontation, not necessarily violent confrontation, but to create sectarian confrontation that makes a common united effort for national development in a given country much harder than it would otherwise be. And and that's obviously been the case in Venezuela, for example. And the United States has fomented division and conflict to make the implementation of a national development plan under the Bolivarian government of Nicolas Maduro as difficult and almost impossible. And that's why I have such admiration for Maduro and his colleagues to have overcome that. But that is the underlying strategy, isn't it, of the United States? Their power, they have no prestige in terms of their economic model or even their political model.
But see, I think at the core...
The political model in the United States is a laughingstock.
Yeah.
And so what they do, and you can see this, and if you follow alternative and corporate news coverage of events in Nicaragua, they're continually focusing on division and conflict, for example, the exploitation of the very complex conflicts over land in the northern Caribbean coast, or for example, the exaggeration of the legitimate protest movements against Interoceanic Canal, for example. There are other examples as well within that. But if you look at other countries, for example, in Bolivia, and the last year, the terrible murder of the Bolivian Interior Ministry by members of indigenous mining cooperatives, these conflicts are stoked. You have this constant provocation from US diplomacy, and that is obviously supported by covert means as well.
We'll have the conclusion of our conversation with Tony Solo later this week.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.